Hello and welcome to How to Deal with Grief and Trauma. My name is Natalie Himmelrich.
How to Deal with Grief and Trauma is completely self-funded, produced and edited by me, Natalie Himmelrich. Consider making a small donation to support the podcast. Go to bit.ly/support, capital G, capital T, and podcast. I repeat, bit.ly/supportgtpodcast. Thank you so much. And for more information, please visit Natalie's website, join the podcast Instagram page, and subscribe to the newsletter to receive updates on future episodes. Julia Samuel has such a vast knowledge in the realm of grief that I feel incredibly lucky to have her as a guest on the podcast. The understanding she is able to share from her over 30 years of experience is exceptional. Here is just one little snippet of what is to come, which for me encapsulates the gift of our conversation.
Most importantly, the support we need is the love of others, that when someone we love dies, it is the love of others that enables us to survive.
I'm absolutely sure that you will enjoy and learn a lot from today's episode. About this week's guest. Julia was psychotherapist for pediatrics at St. Mary's Hospital, Paddington, the post she established in 1992, where her role for 25 years involved seeing families who have children or babies who die, and where she trained and supported the staff. In 1994, she worked to help launch and establish the Child Bereavement Charity, and as the founder patron was involved in many aspects of the charity work, having a key role in fundraising, strategy and training for 25 years. In 2016, Julia was awarded an MBE in recognition of her services to bereaved children, and in 2017, Middlesex University awarded her an honorary doctorate. Later, Julia published her three books, Grief Works, This Too Shall Pass, and Every Family Has a Story, which all became Sunday Times bestsellers. Most recently, Julia produced the Grief Works app and released her new podcast called Therapy Works. She also has a private practice where she sees families and individuals. I recommend you head over to the podcast website to find a gift for today's episode filled with Julia's wisdom, and make sure to check out all the links in the show notes. So welcome, Julia. It's so nice to have you on the podcast.
Delighted to be here. Lovely to be with you.
How are you today?
I'm excited for our conversation. It's a beautiful, crisp day outside of the blue sky, and I've just been for a very quick walk, so I feel really well. Thank you.
Well, I am so excited to be speaking to you, Julia, because the kind of things that you have offered to the world in your life in regards to grief and trauma is so vast that it's an amazement for me to be able to ask you some questions. So maybe we start with the first question. How was your life informed by grief and trauma that you came into this work? What has led you where you are today?
I mean, I think it took me a long time at a deep level to fully understand the meaning of how I got into it, although I knew it cognitively kind of almost immediately. But I was brought up by two parents who were both very significantly bereaved from before I was born. So my mum, her mother, her father, her sister and her brother were all dead suddenly and traumatically by the time she was 25. Mm. And my dad, his father and his brother died by the time he was in his mid-20s as well. So, you know, they both had these huge losses, which they were, you know, I'm much older than you. My parents, my dad fought in the Second World War. Their parents had fought in the First World War. So they were a generation who didn't talk about loss, who the only choice they had really was to get on and survive. Mm-hmm. So none of these people were talked about. And I don't think had been fully processed at all. But I think a lot of that unexpressed emotion was transferred to all of us, but by it not being spoken. And I think that's what influenced me.
Mm. So you've started quite early and you have this huge and biography of all these different roles that you've taken. So for some people who might not know about all the things that you have got your experience from and that you have shaped in this world, why don't we go through a little bit so people get a picture, a life picture, a lifeline of Julia?
Yeah, so I mean, in some ways, the context is I married very young. I'm still married to the same person. So I married at 20 and I had four children by the time I was 29. And then at the age of 29, I started training as a psychotherapist. I did voluntary work and started training as a psychotherapist. And then I got my first job, which was in the NHS. And I pioneered a role in at one of our central London hospitals, supporting families when a baby and a child dies. And I did that job for 25 years. So working, you know, every week with families whose babies would die in stillbirth or neonatal death or miscarriage or terminations for abnormality or children that died from meningitis or cancer or suicide or drowning or car crashes or bike crashes. So I did that for 2.5 decades. And early into my work there, I worked to establish a new charity, which is now a very kind of significant charity called Child Bereavement UK. Mm-hmm. And I was founder patron, still am founder patron. But I've stepped down from being so active. But for another 25 years, I was very active in fundraising and training and trying to inform both families and medical professions and all the helping professions about what families need when a child dies or when a child is bereaved. And then I stepped away both from the NHS and Child Bereavement UK a few years apart and was in private practice, and I've written 3 best-selling books, Grief Works and This Too Shall Pass and Every Family Has a Story. And I've developed an app called the Grief Works app, which is a sort of 28-day course. It's much more than an app. It's like being in therapy with me. Mm-hmm. And it has a 28-day course, and it has like 40 tools that can support you in a journal and access to grief chat and a grief counselor. So it's like everything you need in an app. And then recently I've started a podcast, which I do with my 2 therapist daughters, Therapy Works. So that's it, speedily through like 34 years of being a therapist.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, yeah, exactly. In a couple of minutes, your life's work, but as we spoke just before recording it, there's always something to do. And people on this podcast, the listeners, they know that where it started for me, meaning where I really became into what I was meant to do all along, but where it became really solidified was through the death of my younger twin daughter. She was 3 days old. So when you were talking about child bereavement, I'm wondering what made you go into this field as a mother of 4 young children at that time, because I know that for a parent to have the right kind of support just at that moment is pivotal in how they deal with
it. Changes your outcome. Absolutely. That's why Child Bereavement UK was so important to me, because what happens to you at that moment really impacts your outcome and for the whole family and everyone around you. So I, while in the sort of 10 years of me having children, I worked with the charity, which was then called Birthright. And I was chairman of the fundraising committee, but very kind of learned a lot about the work, which was research around early miscarriage and women's health and pregnancy. And so I went to hospitals and I met researchers, and I really was kind of struck by something that had not even crossed my mind, that a baby could die at birth. Yeah. I mean, I'd been so lucky. Mm-hmm. I was completely, you know, I was young and I was very ignorant. And so that's, I think, what led me to St. Mary's. Yeah.
Mm. Yeah, I can completely understand. I mean, I was I was pregnant for the first time with twins when I was already older. I was 40 something. I have to calculate now. But also at that time, I also wasn't faced with a lot of experiences of people who have lost their babies. Like, I've heard of miscarriages, but in terms of postnatal loss in the first 28 days and how people deal with that, it was not something that I had met until that moment. And as much as I actually studied psychotherapy before, and grief and loss was one of my favorite subjects, and as part of that, we watched a film that was dealing with child loss, I wasn't really prepared until I was going through that myself. And I hear again and again people that I interview or clients of mine that they come into this experience completely unprepared.
I mean, I do think at some level you can never be prepared for a loss of that significance, that in that moment that your twin daughter died, your future and the expectation of the future that you had every right to trust and believe in died with her. Mm-hmm. And a part of you died too. And the process of that, however much cognitively you may be told, you know, this is what people feel and this is what happens, you can never be prepared for it. In the same as in palliative care, you can be with someone who's your dad, who's had a long, good life and has a peaceful, good death, and you're beside him in the hospice or at home for the last 10 days and, you know, has the kind of death that you'd hope for. But that moment of death, when they've actually gone, you're never prepared. There's something visceral of death in that moment that cognitively, if the mind-body response is always in a heightened state and kind of takes a lot of work for your brain to adjust to this new reality. Even if it's one that you can really go with, you know, my dad had a happy life or whatever it is. It's very different. You know, death out of time, a baby dying before they've even had any kind of life, tears up the rule book of life. And in some ways, I don't think you can ever accept that. You have to find a way of living with it and accommodating it. But it's never okay. It's a very different death.
I'm glad you say that. I'm glad you say you can never be prepared. And I'm also glad that this being out of the rule of nature or the way we believe it should happen, that this shakes something out of the naivety that people have in terms of timeliness of death, that where you're suddenly, I've befriended death in a way that I never knew I could, in also over the years in a positive way. And I'm glad the way you said that was really beautiful, that it also makes a difference how someone dies, when someone dies. It's obvious to us as grief workers, but it's important for people to hear that.
I think what's important to add is, I mean, there's many things because, you know, we've only just tapped on the edge of an enormous subject, but people often talk about worse or better, like there's a hierarchy. And I think that's very unhelpful. So I think there's complexity and that there's layers of complexity and there's deaths that are good deaths that aren't complex. So I think that's in some ways takes away from this competition in mine is worse than yours, which I think can often deny our own experience because you're so busy trying wanting to convince someone that yours is bad that you actually lose the focus and the compassion that you need for yourself and the meaning of what's happened to you, because you're so much wanting someone to understand what your experience is, and you can get lost down that kind of alleyway of comparison. And I think the other aspect of it, which of course you know and I'm sure people listening know, is that there are universal kind of emotions that we name around death and the unique experience of it that is informed by our attachment, our experience, the support we have at the time, the investment in the person that died, what we expected, you know, our previous losses, all of that is so uniquely ours. It's like a fingerprint or a footprint. That it's, and the thing you want when you're grieving is to be able to make sense of it for yourself, when, like a baby dying, you can never make sense of, but you long to be understood. Mm-hmm. Like, this is what it's like. And it's, there's so much to be understood. It's very hard.
You said something interesting there about the complexity, the different layers as well within the complexity. Can you say something a little bit more out of your experience, years of experience as part of the Child Bereavement UK, for people to maybe also get a little bit more understanding and normalization of their own experience, those who listen?
So I think what I mean by kind of every layer of complexity, so it's a child dying and not an adult after a long life, mm-hmm. the circumstances of the dying, there was maybe a mistake or it wasn't a mistake, or, you know, from a medical profession, or there was something that your body failed to do, or, you know, every layer of complexity adds to the winding emotional network in our brains that we have to try and find a way of unraveling and unpicking. And to do that, I think we need a lot of compassion and knowing that we can't find answers, but finding ways of naming, I feel this and this and this about that that happened. And I feel this and this and this about that that happened, that you can find pathways into yourself, into the home of yourself, and name what your experience is in that micro aspect of it. And that's a kind of relief. Because a lot of, you know, grief is invisible. You look in the mirror, you see the same person. Internally, you feel completely obliterated. Mm-hmm. And so I think often finding and naming the narrative and the feelings and the words of every bit of that obliteration begins to create a new map in your mind and a kind of story that you can find a way of coming to terms with. And until you do that, I think it keeps, particularly with trauma, it obviously keeps igniting and triggering you.
Mm. So what comes to mind when you speak is various clients and people that I've spoken to as part of the podcast. And some of the topics or questions that I hear is, for example, do I need therapy or support? Do I need that to be able to, and now we want, I don't want to put the word like heal or get over, because certain people have a difficult relationship with either of those, but
accommodate the losses, come to terms,
to integrate the loss into their lives. Do you find it is necessary or not for everyone?
I really don't think that therapy isn't a panacea for all else. And it isn't for everyone. I think, you know, what the research shows, whatever the circumstances of the death, is that the support you get at the time of the death and following the death is what predicts your outcome. Mm. So you need support. And most importantly, the support we need is the love of others, that when someone we love dies, it is the love of others that enables us to survive. You know, people need people, and our path to finding our new normal and our new way of living again has to be paved with people, with love and connection. So therapy is one kind of structured way of love, if you like. It's a kind of loving, I think. But if it isn't a massively traumatic death, grief is naturally adaptive. And people can find ways of both expressing their grief and naming it and getting on with life and doing things that support them, that they don't need to see a therapist. And it will depend a lot on their history and their psychological makeup and their attachment a style, all of those things. There'll be so many aspects of it.
Hmm. So one question that I have, it's fantastic to be speaking with you. I remember there's some clients who come and they want to work, they're open to looking at what I call that grief crystal from all different sides and feel it and get to know it and understand it or accept it, whatever it is. And then they live with someone, in the case of grieving parents, who might not be willing to do that, who might have an attachment or a coupling between the pain and the grieving equals the connection to the loved one or the baby who died. What do you, from your experience, say to those people or those couples who find it difficult with their different grieving styles, or maybe some partner don't want to integrate the loss?
So I think for most people listening, in a family, their partner or their parents and their siblings, there will always be different ways of grieving. There isn't one right way. And when you're in it, I think it can be quite like a fury that you kind of want people to come in and join you in it and be in the pit with you and feel with you and kind of do it together. And it can be in that fury state, or it can be in the other way of kind of despair. And I think what really matters is to allow difference, to allow people to be who they are and express themselves in the way that they are, and communicate and speak and understand the differences. So rather than sort of sitting there and resenting it or blaming and shouting, like, you're obviously not grieving because you're going to work and you seem fine and you want sex with me, or, you know, whatever it is that you're all right. And I'm the one that's suffering. Rather than that, is to collaborate. Like, what is going on for you? How do you experience and express your grief? How is my grieving affecting you? Let me tell you how your grieving is affecting me. What are the things that we can do that we might be able to share that is enough of each other? Like, it might be going for a walk together and we can talk about the baby that died for a little bit of it, and then the rest of it we don't need to, because that might be too much for you. And then we can go and have a pizza or a cup of tea or a glass of wine. And so that we can, because it's important to connect, but not to impose and not to direct.
Mm. It's funny, because that's exactly what the people that I interviewed for my first book, what they said. They said we need to, or what has helped in their grieving, they named understanding different grieving styles and accepting each other's differences. These were the top things that they mentioned.
Can I add one more thing?
Sure.
I think what can throw fire on the flames is that we feel so powerless. We are so powerless and at the mercy of these our grief emotions, that we can get pulled in the opposite pole of powerlessness, of wanting to have control or power. And it's that button that gets pushed with the people around us, that we want them to do what we're doing or how we're doing it, because you want to be able to shape something or influence something or get heard. And I think when you can hold both, that I am powerless and at the mercy of these emotions and what's happened to me, and we can collaborate and understand each other and have a sense of agency together of how do we do this together, that we can have some kind of connective agency and choices and things that we do, that helps recalibrate the awful powerlessness. But it isn't this top down, I'm going to have power over you, that I think often gets in the way.
Well, thank you for adding that. That's a really good point, because I see that as well, where the lack of power, as in the death that happened, where there's this realization, nothing that I did helped.
Made any difference.
Mm. Made any difference. And then, well, what does that mean for life in general? Because I had the idea or the perceived notion that I had some control. You know, one of the things that often comes, and I'm sure you have a lot of experience, I'd love to hear your view on that, is the guilt that people feel. What would you say about that topic in terms of guilt relating to grief or a loss that has happened when that comes up?
So Elizabeth Kubler-Ross of the Five Stages famously said, guilt is the most painful companion of grief. And there are many hues to guilt. And it can, you know, so just to name the domains, it can be the relationship that gives you guilt, that if you're a parent, you feel more guilt because the kind of definition of a good parent is a healthy child. So it could be the relationship. It could be the circumstances of the death that gives you a lot of guilt. It could be that you feel guilt for being alive. It could be that you feel guilt for the missed things you said or the missed things that you'd done, or, and you know, I'm not going to name them all, but it's a whole kind of landscape of guilt. And you can have a lot of those at the same time. And when I'm working with clients, like I did with someone today, what I kind of try and get them to, I get them to name what they feel guilty about. And what isn't helpful to say, well, you've got nothing to be guilty about. This wasn't in your gift. You know, you couldn't save their life. What's helpful is to name it and kind of unpack it, but also recognize that often the feeling we have in our heart is one of guilt. And cognitively in our head, we know that this isn't in our gift, that we're not God. We had no control. We had no power, or we only knew what we knew at the time. We did not have hindsight. And so that you again can hold and allow the feeling of guilt and the fact that we're not guilty, rather conflating the two, that we are guilty. And I think even in that kind of unhooking, there's a bit of space, and in the space, you can receive some compassion and turn to yourself with kindness, like, ooh, this is a moment of suffering. I feel really guilty, and that's really painful. And in the turning for suffering and kindness, you can kind of open yourself up to another feeling, because we all suffer. And then we don't use, so, you know, I often talk about a shitty committee. We often, if we're guilty, we then use our critical mind as a barrister or a judge and jury to throw on other assaults and things that were going to be tried for. And it's like, in though when you unhook it and open yourself, like, I feel really, this really hurts, and I'm going to be kind to myself, it can also release you from the ruminating, circling self-attack.
That was beautifully put. It's like this, to me, the picture came off this different levels of, you mentioned the heart and the mind, where it's acknowledging the feeling that you have, which in this case is guilt. It could be any other thing, where the mind thinks something else. And I'm circling back to what you said before about the death, when it happens, when you, before the death, when it happens and you know it's going to happen, let's say your father is in hospice and you know it's going to come. To me, I had this experience when my cat died, because I knew, okay, when there this moment comes, I have to make the decision to put her to sleep. And so for me, at that time, there was this experience of, as long as it was cognitively understandable, making sense, and oh yeah, yeah, I can think about it, all reason about all this. And as soon as it becomes into the present moment, to me, it felt like it was sinking into my heart. And suddenly I felt all the things that up here I wasn't able to conceive, because I wasn't in the moment. And similar to acknowledging our feelings and having this paradoxical state, be able to say, well, I feel that. I know I'm not guilty, but I still feel it.
Liberating.
Yeah. When you look back over all these years of collected experience and amazing moments that you had with people who were dealing with grief and trauma, what would you say, what insights and resources have helped them and you as part of integrating grief and acknowledging it?
I've written like 3 books, so there's lots of answers. And so it is actually impossible to hone it down to one kind of snippet or reel of an answer. But I think how we heal in grief is by allowing ourselves to feel the pain. And the things that we do to block the pain are the things that over time do us harm, even for generations. And in allowing ourselves to feel the pain, we also, at the same time, need to access support. And it is support, like I said before, of others, but also it's our relationship with ourselves and the person that's died, so that we do the things that actually physiologically help us. You know, the grief is a mind-body essence that's kind of throwing itself through our body. So we need to exercise. We need to regulate our system. We need to put good things into it so it feels okay. And look at things that, you know, I think we can lean on beauty. You know, when we're kind of feeling like we're in the worst place possible, beauty, you know, of nature or pictures or music can be extremely helpful. So it's giving yourselves permission to both feel the pain and actively do things that support you. What, and that's a big, you know, that's a big stack of stuff.
Yeah, we're just giving a glimpse, and all those people who are interested in your books, they will find all the links in the show notes anyway. And I can highly recommend that this won't be the last meeting that you have with Julia and her wisdom. What you said just before ties very much into what I have most recently been delving into, which is the nervous system and the regulation of the nervous system, because I can see now with my polyvagal mind
lens, that
with my polyvagal lens, is all these supporting things is a way to regulate the nervous system, and this is the basis of it all, as far as I'm feeling it and experiencing personally and with people around me. One question that I wanted to ask you, Julia, is about public grief. You know, people find it really complexly difficult to understand when they grieve for someone they don't know personally. So just recently, I think it was Matthew Perry who died, and there was a lot of onslaught of images and people commemorating him. So what is it about public grief that would help us make sense of it if we're experiencing it?
I think it is a real thing. I think, you know, and then more and more with social media and kind of virtual worlds that we live in, that we have these virtual relationships. You know, they're called parasocial relationships, where people, you know, I felt I knew Matthew Perry because it was in my 40s. And my children were teenagers watching Friends together. So it was a particular time of our lives together and a great joy together. And so he was part of that joy. So he becomes part of a particular phase of my life. So I did feel like this, oh, that's really sad. That's because it represents both the end of his life, and he obviously had a complicated life, but also the end of a kind of particularly joyous time of mine. So I think it's the two things we grieve for. It's, you know, people, when it's musicians die, people talk about it as they were the playlist of my 20s or the playlist of my 30s, or, you know, I asked my wife to marry me on this song and now that person's died. So we do have a relationship with them, I think. And so I think we need to legitimize that. And the people do it by rituals or coming together in vigils. I think collectively doing things together in all of collective grief, I think, is incredibly powerful. Like here in the UK, we have a remembrance service just last week on November the 11th, which marks those that have died in the First and Second World War. And we have poppies and there's a ceremony, and it marks the invisibility of the lives that have died in war. And I think rituals are kind of like habits with soul that we can mark significant deaths in our life. And I think doing it with other people, I think it adds the power of 10, you know, that you have a bigger sense of warmth and connection in acknowledging this person has died when we come together and lighter, you know. I think there have been many vigils for particular, you know, like John Lennon or particular people that have died. I think the other thing to hold as well is sometimes we, when someone else dies, it puts us in touch with our own losses that are too painful and too acute to let ourselves really cry. So, you know, it's a bit like watching a sad film. Sometimes it's easier to cry in a sad film, even when you're bereaved, because you're not defending yourself. You're not holding back. You're not frightened of what you're feeling. So I think there's a way, and this doesn't diminish people's experience or their feelings, but sometimes Matthew Perry, for instance, or a public figure's death helps us access our own uncried tears, and that is legitimate too.
Mm. Yeah, I completely agree. I think it's somehow similar to when there's grief activation or triggers, as they're also called, where I'm not defended, I'm not bracing against this to come. I see a scene somewhere in a movie or in a series, and suddenly I'm taken back to where it was. And I also find it interesting myself that this works even better when I'm by myself, because then I have even less to brace myself or to keep face in front of others. The interesting thing that I find is I'm watching a series with my daughter now currently, and she looks at me and she takes a model of how do I react to certain things. And that's such a beautiful way of teaching her how it can be met, how it can be not braced against, how we can allow whatever feelings there are in relation to something.
I think children learn to model by, we model for our children how to respond to the emotional times in our lives. And some of them are certainly watching films together. I mean, definitely I always cry in films. And so my children, when they were younger, they would like turn and see, exactly. Is mom crying? Is she crying? yeah. No, she's crying. Yeah, there she is. Or my son hates going to the movies with me because I'm always so responsive. I'm like, ah! And he's like, mom, shut up. When he was a teenager, he used to go and sit himself like three rows away because I drove him. I didn't really like frightening films. And he'd want to go and see some, I don't know, Black 3 or whatever it was. But yes, I think it's healthy. I think it's sad, funny enough. I mean, I know this isn't to do with grief, but the kind of individualized watching means you don't collectively watch things together at the same time. I think there is a loss in that.
Yeah, absolutely. So if people want to connect with you, before we come to the rapid fire question, also give us a little bit of an idea of the three podcasts and the books that you have so people can pinpoint where should they go from here.
So the podcast that I release a new episode every week at the moment, and my two therapist daughters have a segment at the end.
From you.
Yeah. So that's called Therapy Works, and that's wherever you get your podcasts. Mm-hmm. And we have a different voice every week, and sometimes it's a well-known voice. And every other week it is an unknown voice, which I really like. So it's people who've never, they're not famous, they have no kind of prepared experience, and it's not kind of produced inside them as it can be. It's not performative. And those are very powerful, those episodes. There's lots of grief in those episodes.
Mm.
And then I did This Too Shall Pass, which was about change. I did, I think, 6 episodes, and then I did 6 or 8 grief works. And then my books are called Grief Works, which came out in 2017. It's in lots of languages for people listening abroad. It's in 17 territories. All my books are about between 17 and 20 territories. And then This Too Shall Pass, which was about change, came out March 2020 at the beginning of the pandemic. Mm. And then the last book came out in 2022 was Every Family Has a Story, which is about transgenerational patterns in families.
Oh, fantastic. So we're going to put the links in the show notes. And right. It's really good to just go to Julia's website. There's a hub to her podcast, to her books, to her app. So I highly recommend getting right into all the resources that you have collected over all those years.
Pleasure. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much for all the wisdom that you have shared with us today. And there's so much more, as you were saying. I mean, we're giving short answers. We're giving sort of snippets for people to say, hey, this is something I need to delve more into. So what I do with all of my guests on my podcast, I ask them sort of 5-sentence starters. And would you like to do that now?
Yeah, let's see.
So grieving and trauma means?
The emotional response to loss from death or a living loss.
And healing means?
Finding a way of living with the pain of loss and loving and living again.
And what have you learned about yourself in the light of loss and trauma and all the people that you've worked with in your life?
I feel very grateful every day to be alive, and I want everyone I love to stay alive too.
And what would be one thing you wish people knew about loss and trauma?
That we can help each other by supporting and sharing up and being there for each other. Don't hide away from it.
What would be one specific thing that has changed since the losses or trauma that you have experienced in your life that you wouldn't want to miss?
That I loved them in the first place. That I grieve them because I love them. Yeah, the power of the relationship, and I still love them. Yeah.
Thank you so much. It's been such an honor to have this time with you. For me to have been able to sit here with you is a huge honor. Thank you.
Completely my pleasure. Thank you so much. I hope it's helpful for people listening.
Thanks for listening to How to Deal with Grief and Trauma. If you'd like to be updated on future episodes, please subscribe to my newsletter on nataliehimmelrich.com. If you need grief support, please contact me for a 30-minute free discovery session. How to Deal with Grief and Trauma is produced and edited by me, Natalie Himmelrich. To support this podcast, please rate, review, and subscribe to or follow the podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. And remember to keep reading. I promise it will get easier.